ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
There was once a time when flipping through the channels on your television during the day meant inevitably coming across soap operas. At one point, nearly 20 different daytime soaps were on the air. They were ubiquitous. Even if you weren't a fan, it was impossible to miss them. Today, though, only 4 are left on the main broadcast networks. Still, the impact that these programs have had on our culture is profound. On this edition of UWM Today, we welcome Elena Levine, who's just written a book that traces the history of TV soap operas in our country. It's called Her Stories: Daytime Soap Operas and U.S. Television History. Elena is a professor of English and Media, Cinema, and Digital Studies at UWM, and it's so good to have you with us, Elena.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I remember growing up as a kid in Cudahy, laying on the living room floor with a big television in the wooden case and wanting to watch cartoons, but my mom and my sister were having none of that.
Yeah.
There was serious life going on. And it was called a soap opera.
Oh, yeah.
They had a lot of company, didn't they?
They sure did. Part of the focus of my book is really on how important and significant daytime soap opera has been historically over the whole history of television in American culture. Really goes further back than that into radio. The form started in radio. And so my research is mainly focused on that transition from radio to TV and then throughout the history of TV. But they were an incredibly influential form in terms of the business of television, in terms of our culture and our ways of thinking about largely around issues around gender identity and about family relationships and those kinds of things, but on a much wider array of subject matter as well. And also just on sort of television itself, how television figured out how to tell stories and get us involved with characters and those kinds of things. And so I was really amazed and excited to see how influential the form has been when you look at it across all of TV history.
It really is about stories. I mean, your book begins, the headline is Her Story, and in fact, that's what makes us click as social beings, isn't it? Being able to share something.
For sure. And, you know, one of the things that I discuss in the book is about how well this form managed to use television to tell stories that their audience got incredibly invested in. And part of it is that these programs were on every day. And so people could turn on their TV, before that, turn on their radio, and listen to the stories continuing every day. And it's pretty hard to resist that kind of storytelling when there's cliffhangers at the end of episodes, and you kind of want to come back and learn more about these characters that you come to care about.
Well, let's go back to the beginning when these programs first started. You mentioned radio, and what was it that made it click in that medium, knowing that you couldn't see any of these characters? You couldn't see the passion or the pain on their face,
right.
But still they were very successful on the radio format.
Yes, incredibly successful in radio. As a matter of fact, the form was so successful in radio that there was a lot of hesitancy about transitioning it to television in the 50s because the broadcast networks and the sponsors were making a lot of money off of these programs in radio. And in part, they were so lucrative because their audience, who was largely at the time housewives, would be doing their housework while they were listening. And so part of the fear about television was, are the housewives going to actually just stop doing their housework and just stop and watch TV all day? So there was a lot of uncertainty about that. But
God forbid.
Yeah. I mean, radio, as you know, is a very effective storytelling medium. The oral, the sound, is incredibly powerful. And when the form transitioned to TV, they found ways to bring the visual into it as well. But the sound, the audio quality, was always really important. Music cues, for example, you know, really significant to alerting the audience, pay attention, something important is going to happen. That continued into TV. But that was a technique developed very much so in radio.
So back in radio days, again, lots of stories about daily life, the problems that people have. How detailed? How authentic were the stories, though? Were they about life as people dreamed it should be, or did they get into the real meaty issues that sometimes tear families apart?
Yeah, I mean, in the radio days and through much of the TV years as well, the form was actually very much about everyday life and the real problems that people tend to face. In the TV version in particular, there were periods that were much more kind of fantastical and over the top and very, you know, wealthy characters, characters that most people was not like most people's everyday lives. But for the vast majority of the history of soap opera, whether in radio or TV, the stories were really about everyday people. Now, sometimes those were everyday people facing circumstances that were probably more intense and elaborate than most people's real lives had, but people could find ways to relate to them. So it would be things about families being torn apart, sometimes for kind of outlandish reasons, but the feelings about that and about what it meant to be separated from your loved ones were real, and people could really relate to that. And then there were particular time periods, again, in the radio era and in TV, when they were dealing with really pertinent contemporary issues. So this started in the radio era during World War II, and a lot of serial producers then started to tell stories about characters going off to war and what it meant for the people on the home front and those kinds of issues, and had, you know, women characters going to work in factories during the war and things like that that really spoke to the experiences of real people. And that continues.
It must have been comforting for women, especially if their husbands or boyfriends were off to war, to know that they weren't alone, right?
I mean, for sure.
Provided some sort of a connection to the rest of the people who found themselves in that same situation.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, because my book is focused on television, I don't have as much about the World War II period, but there's really interesting research on that and about the way that the U.S. government wanted to get these daytime serials to help support the war effort by encouraging women to go to work during the war when they needed women to be working in the factories and such at home. And there were a lot of men off serving in the military. And so the role that that played, both like officially in terms of the U.S. position in the war, but also just in terms, like you were saying, of people's everyday lives and having some comfort in having characters that you're invested in having similar experiences to you or struggling with the same kinds of problems, was really meaningful for a lot of people.
Well, you mentioned the war during the radio days of the soaps, World War II. How did the soap operas deal with the cultural changes and uproar that occurred during the Vietnam War?
Yeah. Surprisingly enough, some of the soaps dealt really overtly with the Vietnam War. There's programs that had characters, young men who got drafted and would go off to war and eventually were killed in action and, you know, things like that happening. And there were, you know, female characters who were anti-war protesters. There was a program in the 70s, in the late 60s that had a Vietnam vet, who had come home and was dealing with the problems he was facing. That continues even into the 80s. There were stories about Vietnam veterans. But a form that I think we tend to think of as sort of, you know, fluffy and silly was actually in certain time periods like that one dealing with some of these real world issues and concerns.
How about the viewers? We mentioned the women who watched, and the fact that's why the soaps were created. In fact, we should probably mention the name soap opera. That had a direct connection to home life, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the name was, you know, initially a pretty disparaging label that was placed to these programs. People who worked in the business tended to call them serials instead of soap operas. They thought soap opera was a bit of an insult. And later it would change and that would become just sort of the accepted term. But the term came from the fact that the programs were sponsored by domestic goods companies who made products like laundry soap and dish soap. So big companies like Procter & Gamble was a major one, but others, Colgate, Palmolive, you know, companies that are still with us today. And they had commercials for their products during the programs, and so they were talked about as, you know, peddling soap, as selling soap. The opera part of it was meant to be kind of a part of that insult, that dig, by combining something as kind of banal and everyday as soap with this high art form that was known to be very, you know, melodramatic and over the top. And so this, what was assumed to be very melodramatic about the storytelling combined with their kind of function to sell soap, was where that term came from.
I have to admit, I didn't watch soaps closely, but I was around people who did.
Sure.
And I gotta say that a lot of the guy friends that I had were regulars. I remember sitting in a college dorm room back in the a long time ago, and there were guys who were saying, I don't want to go out and play ball right now. My show is on.
And yeah.
It wasn't a football game. It was a soap opera.
Yeah.
Was that uncommon, or were there a lot of men who tuned in over the years, just as women did?
Yeah. I mean, even though the form is very associated with women, what I found in my research is that there were a lot of time periods where they became incredibly popular with a much broader audience than that. So men as well as women, kids and teenagers and college students especially, and adults. People of all ages, genders, lifestyles started to get invested in the programs, particularly starting in the mid to late 60s and through kind of the 80s. That's really the heyday of there being this pretty broad cross-section audience. And I'm not surprised about your story about college because, you know, college students were hugely invested. And of course, these were back in an era where most students wouldn't have had their own TV set in their room. So they would gather in, you know, student unions or, you know, common rooms in dorms or fraternity houses and sorority houses and, you know, gather together and watch these episodes. There's lots of great stories about college students scheduling their classes around their favorite soaps and things like that.
Geography. Who has to study for geography?
Yeah, exactly.
Who came up with the ideas, the plot lines, the narratives? You mentioned how contemporary a lot of these topics were. Mm-hmm. Were there any psychologists at the table, or were these all fiction writers?
They were mostly fiction writers. Occasionally, the writers would call in consultants, often for medical issues or legal issues, because there's lots of, you know, mysterious diseases in soap operas, and there's lots of, you know, bizarre, legal cases, and they want to have some connection to reality. And so they would often consult with experts on those sorts of things. Some psychologists as well. But they were... they eventually were written by teams of writers. Initially, they were written by individuals. There's a woman named Erna Phillips who was sort of the creator of the form in radio, and she wrote her own shows. She would dictate them to her secretary, and she would voice all the characters, and the secretary would type up the scripts, and then it would go out for the actors to perform. And so there's this kind of legacy of these, what eventually became known as head writers, so the people who usually... individual, sometimes two people working together, who would really plot out the big stories. And then the kind of breaking those down into individual daily scripts, especially once the episodes started to get longer in television, would be kind of farmed out to dialogue writers. So they were teams of writers, although many soaps had a kind of one or two people who were the sort of creative vision for the stories.
Yeah. You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. Good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack, and joining us in the studio today is Elena Levine. Elena is a professor of English and Media, Cinema, and Digital Studies on the faculty at UWM. We're talking about a new book that she has just come out with. It's called Her Stories, Daytime Soap Opera and U.S. Television History. Elena, you were talking just a moment ago about the writing that was responsible for turning out these soaps. And again, at one point, nearly 20 of them on network TV all at the same time. The pressure must have been fantastic because you had these fresh episodes day after day after day. And some of these programs ran an hour long.
Yes.
How in the world did they imagine or think up enough plot lines to be able to sustain this?
Yeah, it's quite amazing when you go and look at it, at how much content those shows put out. And, you know, there's still four on the air that continue to put out this much content. Initially they were 15 minutes in radio, gradually expanded to a half hour in the early days of TV, and then go to an hour eventually. And most, there's some half hour shows continued, but most were an hour long. And so that's, you know, 5 days a week of an hour episode. And so they would be, the way it eventually, the form evolved was to have this kind of structure of different writers with different levels of responsibility. But amazingly enough, these head writers would just come up with these extended plots. Now, part of it was as the shows got longer, the casts got bigger. So they had more characters to play with, and they could move move people in and out of stories and find ways to connect the different characters into different stories. But, you know, eventually sometimes that went into, like, pretty fantastical sorts of tales when they were kind of trying to find new ways to keep the story going.
Of course, a lot of these programs appeared before there were a lot of talk shows on the air. If you turn on TV today, instead of finding soap after soap after soap as you channel surf, you're more likely to find the successors to Oprah, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody who was anybody in the entertainment business, it seems, either has had or wants to have their own talk show. And those are fairly expensive to produce because you've got a big production team, often giving away prizes and the like. Were these programs, the soaps, expensive to produce?
Well, part of their utility for the broadcasting business was always that they were relatively inexpensive, especially compared to primetime television. In part because they would work in studios that were dedicated to their production. They had the sets and the equipment, and they could, churn out these episodes on a daily basis at relatively low cost, and they could have more minutes of advertising time than primetime did. So even though the ads cost less for the advertisers in daytime, they sold more of them, and they brought in a lot of money, kept production costs low. But part of what, you know, happened in more recent decades is that, you know, they're more expensive to produce, scripted programs like soaps are, than, say, a talk show or even like a reality TV type show, because you just have more production overhead to maintain studios and to have the crews and to light sets and all of those things, not to mention the large casts. And so that, I think, is part of what has made that it kind of the programs less likely to have continued in recent decades as part of those cost issues.
So soaps got more expensive as casts got larger. And as you just point out now, in fact, those talk shows are an even cheaper form to media to produce.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're Oprah, who is, you know, probably making a lot of being...
Well, she gave cars away right. for everybody in the audience.
Right.
There may never be another Oprah.
There probably will never be another Oprah because we don't have that kind of television anymore. We don't have television that draws that wide an audience anymore, except, you know, the Super Bowl.
And of course, now you have hundreds of cable channels to choose from. That also contributed to the decline in the number of soap operas.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, really, the soaps kind of peak in the early 80s, which is, of course, the same time that cable is getting started in terms of their soaps peak then in terms of their popularity and their profitability. And then sort of from the mid to late 80s on, things start to decline. And in part, it's right. It's because our options have multiplied so much. First cable and, of course, now the internet have made their, you know, many more options. You're not, you know, stuck as you once were with watching one of three broadcast national networks plus PBS during the day if you wanted to watch TV.
And then there's HGTV, right?
Yeah.
That's a soap opera in a sense, isn't it?
In some ways it is, yes.
Little mini soaps, watching people decide what house is going to work and what house they're going to flip and what house they're going to remodel and what house they're going to sell.
Yeah.
I mean, there's drama built into each of those storylines.
For sure. I think that, you know, reality kinds of programs, whether it's an HGTV style or kind of the continuing reality shows about celebrities or competition shows, are fitting some of those same pleasures that people got from soap opera and just putting them in different forms. And so that's partly kind of the desire for this kind of storytelling doesn't go away. We just have found new ways to scratch that itch, I guess.
At the beginning of the program, I mentioned that there are only four soap operas still on the main networks. Mm-hmm. Listeners, can you name what those four are? Don't worry. I'm not going to make you work too hard. They are The Bold and the Beautiful, Days of Our Lives, General Hospital, and The Young and the Restless. Any recurring theme or trait within those four that made them be the survivors, Elena?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if there's any one quality of them compared to the other soaps that, you know, have left the air over the last, like, 10 to 15 years. There's basically one soap left on each of the three major networks, except for CBS, which has an hour and a half because one of their shows, The Bold and Beautiful, is a half-hour show. Those shows, The Young and the Restless and The Bold and the Beautiful, have a really large international following. They are sold quite widely around the world and are incredibly popular. Like, the stars of the shows get, especially The Bold and the Beautiful, are mobbed when they step foot in Italy, for example.
Do they translate them? Do they dub them over in
the... I think
think that sometimes they're dubbed and sometimes they have subtitles. But yeah, and they are, you know, some of the most popular programs on the air in various parts of the world. And so those shows have really been able to survive in part because they have these big, you know, international revenues coming in. And so they're also, you know, still doing well in terms of their popularity in the U.S., but that international market is really important for some of these shows. But some, you know, General Hospital is the only soap opera on ABC. Days of Our Lives is the only one on NBC now. And, you know, those hang on and they have really devoted audiences that I think the networks are, you know, kind of hesitant to anger because they've kind of cut so much else from their daytime schedules, from the kind of programming they had long produced. And so they continue on. But I've stopped making predictions. I fear that any day now another one could go.
You know, just how loyal those viewers are was really driven home to me. Actually, just a few weeks ago, a good friend of mine here in Milwaukee, her mother passed away at the age of 90. Mm-hmm. And in her obituary, the obituary that the daughter wrote of her mother, she said 6 minutes into her favorite show, The Bold and the Beautiful, my mother passed. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just loved that show. And in fact, it was with her the time that she went away. Deep, deep commitment.
For sure. And, you know, the more, you know, as I've worked on this book and as I've been talking about it, as it's coming out, everyone has a story like this. Everyone has a story about someone they know or something they've seen about people's deep investment in these programs. And I just think there's really nothing else like it in our media landscape in terms of maybe sports. Maybe some people's connection to a sports team has a similar bond for them. But I think the daily exposure to the soap storylines is something that is pretty unique.
What about the feminist movement? Mm-hmm. Did that impact the way in which soaps were written, produced, or were able to last?
Yes, definitely. Kind of for the good and the not so good in terms of for what it's meant for soaps. Soaps are one of the places where women have long had a lot of creative control in the media world, which is quite unusual historically. But a lot of the central writers and some of the producers of soap operas have long been women. And so that's a pretty unusual thing to begin with. In many ways, the stories of soap operas are pretty conventional in terms of women's roles because they're very much about family relationships and romantic relationships and things like that. Given all of that, the focus has primarily always been on the women characters and on their stories and their experiences. And I think it's arguable that that is a product of and a credit to feminism as much as anything else, because it's focusing on those stories and those interests, even if sometimes they seem to be following pretty conventional patterns in terms of women's lives. That said, there's also some amazing moments in the history of soap opera, particularly this happened a lot like in the 70s, where you get characters who were being very open and upfront about being invested in the women's liberation movement, being feminists. One of the first, if not the first, legal abortion that was aired on television was on a soap opera on All My Children in 1971. So before Roe versus Wade, but when abortion laws were different by state. And it's not so much that the abortion itself was a feminist thing, but the character sort of advocating for herself and saying that she could determine what would happen for her own body was something that was, you know, very much in the winds of the time in terms of ideas about feminism. Also, lots of women in important professional roles. Even little things like soap operas beginning to be set in hospitals in the 1960s meant that most of the female characters were full-time working women who worked in the hospitals. They were more often nurses than doctors, but there were women doctors as early as the, you know, early 60s as well. And so you had all these different spaces where ideas about what gender roles might be and how they might be changing were being kind of considered and talked about. And that's, you know, I think a really important contribution of the programs to our kind of cultural history.
Were there any connections between the soaps and Wisconsin in particular?
There are a few. Erna Phillips, who I mentioned earlier, was sort of the creator of the Forum in Radio, had been a student at UW-Madison, and the archives at the Wisconsin Historical Society there actually have her papers today. So that's a really cool connection. There's also a soap opera writer named Frank Hursley who taught at UWM in the 50s, I believe, when it
was a
teacher's college, or maybe even earlier than that. And I don't know a ton about it, but I know that he was a college instructor. He also, you know, was a radio writer and then became a TV writer along with his wife, Doris Hursley. And I ran across that at one point, and I was just amazed to see that there was a UWM connection.
Wow, a panther on the soaps.
Yeah. And then, of course, The Young and the Restless is set in Wisconsin, in the fictional Wisconsin, Genoa City, which is, you know, I think a vaguely a vague reference to Lake Geneva.
Yeah, and that's one of the few remaining. The Young and Restless is still on the air. So how about you? Have you had a favorite? Is there a soap that you just either loved or still love?
Yeah. Well, I started watching General Hospital as a kid. As you know, as I was saying, a lot of people, you know, in the era when kids and teenagers were getting really invested in soaps, I got sucked into that as well. And it kind of coincided with some interesting historical developments like the beginnings of the VCR. This was in the early 80s, and my family got a VCR. And we're like, what should we use this new device for? I know, let's record this daytime soap opera every day. And, you know, it's kind of continued. So, I got invested in it then, still watch it today. And kind of along my path of becoming somebody who kind of studies television and teaches students about television and media, have started, you know, developed it as a kind of research and teaching interest as well.
How neat that you're able to bring that part of your past into your research.
Oh, yeah. No, I say this is, in some ways, I've been writing this book my whole life because since I was a kid starting to watch soaps, I've been kind of gathering the material.
How about your family, your kids or your husband watch?
My kids will occasionally watch now. I mean, they're familiar with it because it's on in our house sometimes and will, you know enough about to know certain characters and occasionally ask questions. So I'm working on it, trying to get them a little more hooked.
Just a minute left. Where do you see your research going now that you finished this book?
Yeah, well, this book was a big project that I've worked on for a long time. And so I'm kind of developing a few different projects. One project I'm working on is related to some programming that's made for the web that is soap-like programming. Sometimes they're called web soap operas. And they're more kind of independent productions that are sometimes being created by people from the daytime soap opera world. And they're kind of exploring different issues that the soaps haven't always explored, like LGBT characters or, you know, soap communities of all people of color or things like that. And they're doing some kind of interesting experiments. And so I'm sort of interested in it as a new form of television storytelling that is connected to this older world of soap opera, but is doing some unusual things because of the freedom that the web allows.
Well, we're going to have you back on when you write a book about that, okay? And maybe even before that.
Okay.
Elena, thank you. Delightful conversation.
My pleasure.
Elena Levine, professor of English at UW-Milwaukee. Her new book, Her Stories, Daytime Soap Opera and U.S. Television History, just coming out in the market now. That's all for this week's edition of UWM Today. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities. University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.